This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au. Hello and welcome to Between the Lines, an RTRFM podcast all about books. My name is Danielle Raphael and it's so good to be back with you for another year of literary chats. Today, to kick things off, I'm joined by the delightful Laurie Steed.
I wouldn't say it was an upward trajectory the whole time. Yeah. There's many a time where I've gone, why are you like this, Laurie? What is it even about this rush that makes you want to look at story above and beyond marketability and everything else? And I think it is anchored to risk, and it's also anchored to honouring and acknowledging the tiny part of me that thought, oh, well, it wasn't worth it, and going, no, you're worth it. Like, you matter. Your words matter. Your voice matters.
Laurie is a short story writer from Perth who has had his work broadcast on BBC Radio 4 and published in Best Australian Stories, The Age and Mianjin, just to name a few. He has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Western Australia, with accolades including but not limited to the Patricia Hackett Prize for Fiction. Last year, he released Love Dad, Confessions of an Anxious Father with Fremantle Press. And his latest book, out now, Greater City Shadows, is a series of thought-provoking short stories about the intricacies of relationships and complexities of life set against the backdrop of our very own Perth Boorloo. He's a longtime friend of RTR and just an absolute joy to chat to. So profound and really feel good, I think. I'm excited to share this chat with you. This is Laurie Steed. Laurie, thank you for joining us on Between the Lines.
Thanks, Danny. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and it's so nice to meet you. I was saying before off mic that we have crossed kind of in the past at RTR, you being on with Taylor.
That's correct.
And The Man Who Loves Everything, which was a segment that I always adored on the program. But because it kind of intersected with this little thing that happened called the COVID pandemic, we never really crossed paths.
No, it's sort of it reached a stunning apex, and then the whole world changed, and it was sort of left mid-list. So The Man Who Loves Everything was based on a list I'd written after a friend of mine had passed away, which was things that make life worth living. So I got to mention each of those things. And so funnily enough, I guess having that happen probably fed into writing Greater City Shadows, because I had all these things I wanted to honour and acknowledge and celebrate, but I no longer had the forum with which to talk about them. So I decided to write some stories and see what metaphors I could find, and find my own ways to honour and acknowledge Perth and some of the people who've made it feel like home.
Yeah, there is a Venn diagram of the pandemic, this book, the book you released last year, which we will get into. And, yeah, it really wonderful to have you in today. As I said at the start, a great friend of RTR. And your book, as you kind of alluded to, is this wonderful celebration of Perth and WA and place, and it'll be really great to get into all of that with you. I am wondering, though, on the topic of the pandemic, what was that like as a writer? And maybe we can start with Greater City Shadows and, I guess, the start of that journey and how it relates to the pandemic.
Sure. So I'd completed my first novel, You Belong Here, in 2018, and felt sort of had taken a journey with that. And then I always had this real drive to write a collection of stories next, and I thought that was probably the smartest move. At the time, the publisher I was with then folded, which meant that it wasn't the smartest move. But I also got some funding to work with an editor on Greater City Shadows. So between 2018 and 2019, there was this wonderful creative space in which I was really stepping into and working on what would become Greater City Shadows. It was called Nova then. And then I met with my editor. I remember it was at Chapels on Whatley, and we had tea and sweet treats, and we talked about where we were going to send this book out for the best chance of it being published. And this was February 2020.
Which feels like a lifetime
ago. And by March 2020, it seemed that the whole world had changed. And I just already knew on some level things weren't right for the book either, given what was going on for the world. So I didn't really get that many responses back. I just got this feeling that this was a stage that Greatest of the Shadows was going to have to go through. So for me, the pandemic, in terms of writing, it was actually very tough to find time to write because I have two young boys and they were even younger at that point. So my days became walks around the neighbourhood and looking at all the, you know, the chalk drawings or the teddies in the window.
Yes,
and
yeah.
having baths with one or the other of my boys and sort of talking to them a lot. And so it was a really beautiful kind of idyllic time. I taught my eldest how to ride a bike at abandoned shopping centre car parks and things like that. So it was very sort of strangely like if the post-apocalyptic suddenly got cheery, which is a strange vibe. So I did work a lot mentally on the collection and think about how it might come together. But I found through most of 2020 and definitely up to a point in mid-2021, I didn't do a lot of writing. And then I got what was called the Henry Handel Richardson Flagship Fellowship, which takes one.
Say
to,
that three times.
Yeah, that's right. And that takes one to Varuna, the Writers' Centre in the Blue Mountains in Katoomba, New South Wales. And so I'd gone there with this express aim to fall in love again with Greater City Shadows. And that wasn't meant to be. And in fact, I wrote an entirely different book about having been a dad, especially during the pandemic. So by mid 2022, I was starting to finish my work on Love Dad and get it to the point where it was ready to be published. And at that point, I met up with a friend of mine and we were talking about Greater City Shadows. And she said, look, I notice in this collection there are some stories that are kind of arbitrarily set in different cities around Australia. And she said, I'm going to be honest with you, it feels like those stories are set in Perth and you were just trying to commandeer the collection to better represent the whole of the country. And what if you just owned that and honoured that and acknowledged that? I said, wouldn't that be publishing suicide? And she said, but this is what you do. You write stories about Perth. You love it. You really like engaging with that. So I took a risk, set them all where they were supposed to be set and revisited those stories. And then along came this thing called the Dorothy Hewitt Award. And that every year that's run. And if you win, you get a prize and published. And you've had, obviously, Brendan Ritchie, winner of the same year as mine, Dorothy Hewitt Award on the show. So he won. But there was still me in the shortlist, which I got shortlisted, which was wonderful. And then basically from there, the publisher, Kate Pickard, said, why don't you come in? And I was very sort of suspicious. I was like, why?
Cynical brain.
She said, no, just come in. It'll be great. And so I went in and she said, I love it. I love the book. We really want to publish it. I'll take it to the editorial board first. If they say yes, it's greenlit. So that happened, which was great. So it turned out that it was always trying to find its home. It was just a little lost along the way until it finally made its way back to UWA.
And, very much making its way back to Perth of all places.
Yeah. It's sort of counterintuitive to think that in time. I mean, David Foster Wallace had this quote, of course, although we end up becoming ourselves. And so on some level, I was thinking that me as I existed was maybe not enough.
Yeah.
And then the only way forward was to me to go, well, it is enough. Mm. I write these stories. This is what I want to talk about. And ironically, I didn't need to go around the world in my short fiction for it to get there. I just needed to come home.
Yeah, you were where you needed to be. And connection and relationships are a huge part, connection to place, connection to other people, a big part of your work, I should say. What was that like, again, going back to this time of, you know, starting this book and COVID? What was it like to not have those things? Did it teach you anything new about connection and relationships?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about the nature of writing for me is that if something is no longer available, it gives me a key to that door to open into it. So when I wanted to write about Perth in the 1980s and 90s for You Belong Here, I traveled to Iowa in the States and suddenly all these memories were flooding back in. So I think there's something about the nature of how I process information that if something is not available to me, it gives me the opportunity to reflect. So I think the slowing of the city at that time meant that I had this sort of wistful longing. And I know a review's already talked about how there's so much longing in this book. Mm. And so I think with the present no longer having its wheels spin so furiously, I look back and I reflected. And, yeah, I think, you know, the past is a place that's worth visiting, but you probably don't want to stay too long there.
Yeah, we can always learn something from it. But, yeah, staying too long can, not be great.
So, I mean, it was an interesting thing to see Perth in a slightly different light. I mean, the things that always threw me the most about COVID were actually things like going to a Bunnings and being in a line and having a meter between you and the mask.
Absurd.
And, yeah, it sort of felt like a kind of a surreal thing. And it did have me questioning why we do what we do in normal times, because they suddenly, it seems kind of a futility in trying to keep busy and trying to keep active and avoiding being and consistently doing all the time. So that's the other thing that I guess COVID did for me, was that when you're a father, that is kind of an act of being. And I was around the boys so much that what ended up happening was that I started to open up myself to my boys. And there was a real relief in that, because until that point, I'd felt like as a writer, I had to execute every time. As a father, I couldn't make a mistake. And that's a lot of pressure in a space like that. So COVID, I guess, said to me, stand down, take a break, connect with people. And it's something that hasn't really changed post-COVID for me. I kind of feel like the healing or the recovery is still happening, whatever other sources might want us to believe. I think that mentally and emotionally, it's such a massive thing to go through.
Mm.
So for me, I don't mind if things take longer now. I don't mind if it takes me a bit longer to get through a book. I don't mind if I walk to get a coffee with my son instead of driving us there. All these things are kind of acts of rebellion against the great busyness kicking in once again.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I feel like I know that we didn't experience COVID to the extent that perhaps the eastern states did, or what people overseas did. But there was that learning of slow down, be mindful, and just be. I think that's a really beautiful way of putting it. We get stuck in this capitalistic, hamster wheel.
Yeah.
And it was this really lovely opportunity in a weird way to just slow down, be with family, connect over board games. We would do the things like just hang out and do nothing for hours, you know. So a really wonderful message.
Between the lines.
Between the lines.
Between the lines.
Laurie, when did your writing journey begin?
Oh, wow. I guess probably in earnest I talked about The List, which I started in 1997, and that sort of followed me to the UK. I spent a year in the UK after some pretty heavy events in my life, and I started journaling a lot through that period. And then I enrolled in a journalism degree at Murdoch University in 2002, and at the time I was living with another guy who was also doing the journalism degree with me, a guy called Chris. And we used to take these road trips, desperately sort of trying to find ourselves all up the North Coast. And on one of these, we were on the Kalbarri shore and we were sort of seeing the birds sort of drift across the water. And I just turned to him and I said, "Hey, Chris." And he goes, "What?" And I said, "I think I'm going to be a writer." And he's like, "Oh, my God." And I'm like, "I know. Oh, my God, I'm going to do it. That's what I'm going to do." And he's like, "That's so great, man." And we hugged. And it sort of, from that point on, I began in earnest. So I wrote a book that no one will ever read called Sleeping Giants, which was my first novel between 2002 and 2004. And then from 2004, I entered one story in a comp and it got highly commended, which much thanks to John Harmon for seeing something in this weird little story called Open Mouth. And even looking back on it now, that story, Open Mouth, was a first-person story about a dad who wanted something better for his kids. And I think that was probably the beginning of The Voice. So from 2004 to 2011, I wrote a bunch of short stories, got some published and some had other successes. And then I entered into my PhD, which was the novel You Belong Here, the novel that took a century to write and revise, eventually published in 2018. And with a PhD, especially if you're on scholarship like I was, it was the first time I'd ever been paid to write.
Incredible, right?
Yeah, so I suddenly had all this time. They have a thing called, I think it's called Get It in university libraries, where you can get a book from any library in the world delivered to you. So I read all kinds of short story collections and novels. And then that was sort of the same time I went to Iowa. I got into a thing called the Graduate Summer Fiction Workshop. And then I also went to Bulgaria. I got into a thing called Sozopol Fiction Seminars. So there was this point in Bulgaria where we were looking out, we're on Sozopol, you know, this island looking out at the Black Sea. And two Bulgarian writers began a song cycle. And it went for 34 minutes, them just singing back at each other and rotating and reverberating. And I just knew at the time, I just talked to a friend about it recently, I was like, this is going to be one of those things that I'm always going to remember. And it's experiential, it's not quantifiable, but it's something about my path that's taken me here. Very unique space. And from Iowa and Bulgaria, I never really wanted to fit. I had a feeling that fitting would affect my work detrimentally.
Mm.
So I always really just attached to risk. I thought, well, what if I do it this way? That would be cool. And many a publisher, including some friends, have said to me, no, it's not cool. Can you just do things the way we want and hit a genre and do all that? But I'm like, no, you don't get it. It's really cool. Because this is freedom and I can create and I can do different things that haven't been done before but are in sort of honoring and acknowledge the canon that has come from writers before me. And that deeply excites me. So I think that's one thing I carry into interpersonal reactions in my family is that I never had to settle. I never went, oh, I'll give up on that dreamy part of it. There are challenges with that too. And I'm not exactly, you know, Justin Bieber of the literary world, but it's an immensely rewarding gift that every story I write is how I wanted to write it.
Yeah. What a beautiful way to experience writing. And it amazes me that you have such a good relationship with risk. It seems so counterintuitive to the industry and to, you know, how we as human beings behave because we're always kind of wanting to conform and wanting to mimic. How has that relationship with risk and risk-taking changed over the years, or was it something that kind of came to you a bit later in your journey?
I think when I first started writing, I figured short stories, rather foolishly, it would be my path to greatness or fame or notoriety. And I was 25 when I started writing. So I kind of imagined there was a point where a red carpet was rolled out. In fact, when I got to Iowa, I was expecting a red carpet.
Rolling out, yeah.
And instead I got Dr. Zizi Packer, who said to me my work was okay, and needed a lot of work to be anything worth talking about, which was great at the time. But I think on some level, Zizi Packer in Iowa, and also when I was at Varuna the first time, which was 2012, to work on You Belong Here, I was with a wonderful writer there called Denise, and I was talking about Dave Eggers, who was like, I was a fanboy of Dave Eggers at the time. And I kept talking and talking about Dave Eggers, and then I said, wouldn't that be amazing? Imagine being the next Dave Eggers. And Denise looked at me and she said, well, why would you be the next Dave Eggers when you could be the first Laurie Steed? And I think from that point on, it was like, wait, you mean I could actually be me and work within that intuition and it might work out. So when I say I'm comfortable with risk, I wouldn't say it was a upward trajectory the whole time.
Yeah.
There's many a time where I've gone, why are you like this, Laurie? What is it even about this rush that makes you want to look at story above and beyond marketability and everything else? And I think it is anchored to risk, and it's also anchored to honoring and acknowledging the tiny part of me that thought, oh, well, it wasn't worth it, and going, no, you're worth it. Like, you matter. Your words matter. Your voice matters. So in a way, it's like the older Laurie showed up for the younger Laurie and was like, no, I want to hear what you have to say. So there's a trust there too that I'm going to back my vision. But in terms of risk, I also read some incredible stories. And when I read them, so there's a collection called Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson, which just has these incredible, almost otherworldly visions throughout. And you know it's a risk that they took with that. And then when I read Laurie Moore, she has this wonderful story called Dance in America, and I won't spoil it for you, but there's a real risk taken towards the end of the story, a defiance of how you think the story is going to play out. That's just magical. So I think reading some of the best short story writers of my time, both locally and internationally, I saw that the short story form has this almost mythical space where the rules don't apply if you do the story well enough. So if you pull it off, you've created a new type of story. So Jennifer Egan was another real inspiration for me. She did a story in a PowerPoint presentation and it worked. And it's like, wow, that's a really good story. And so from that point on, it was this sort of interrogation of the form, not to an aggressive experimental level, but the deal was, if I tell a story like this, will it make my heart or will it break my heart or will it make the reader's heart or will it break the reader's heart? So there's always a feeling imperative there too. It's almost like finding some toys you had when you were nine and going, I love that toy. I really love that. And connecting back to that greater emotional literacy you have at a point earlier on and bringing it back into your adulthood. So I guess if adulthood is that dimming of the light, as has been discussed, I want to turn the light back on and I want to bring everything back into the room and have my readers feeling, reflecting and experiencing with all the colours all at once. That's kind of what I want to do.
Yeah, it's just the amount of trust and vulnerability needed to dip back into those sorts of experiences. Super inspiring.
Thank you.
And, you know, short stories are the realm in which you work. But then last year you released Love Dad, as we've mentioned, which is a different form altogether. It was more memoir.
Yeah.
How did you end up writing memoir? And do you have a preferred form, or is that like asking you to choose a favourite son?
I'm very much a friend of mine, Kara Dwin. She says that writers, they're either foxes and they sniff out their next project, or they're hedgehogs and they do the same thing over and over again. And I'm very much a fox, so I sniff out my next project. The memoir's a really interesting one. And I think the reason why Greater City Shadows is out now is that I reached a point when working on it where I realised everything in the book to that point was about execution and another person's perception of what was good. And so I was stuck, profoundly stuck. And I didn't know what the next step was for Greater City Shadows to work. And so ironically, when I went to Varuna and started to write Love Dad, there's basically this voice sort of said, hey, why don't you just be you for a book? Why don't you just talk and share things that are going on for real in your life and see what happens when you do that? And so the deal that I made with my creativity coach, Claire, was that the book would be vulnerable, sincere, and authentic. Those were the three things it had to be. And suddenly the V word opened up a whole new kind of book. So anxiety sort of got a place in the space. So did tenderness. So did the sort of the gentle touch required when you're dealing with wonderful souls at such a young age. And so Love Dad was a strange one because I knew the story and yet I was going back through it and I kept realizing things and reflecting on things. And Love Dad's also written sort of in the soul of my now departed father. And so while looking after him at his most sort of tender time after he'd had an accident, he fell off a roof and into a coma. And then after that, he had some heart problems. So strangely, going back over that time, I didn't realize till he passed, was something of a gift. It was going, hey, this is your last hurrah with your father. I didn't know it when I was writing it. Until I think right in the last chapter I say, I realised this could be the last time I see my dad. And I still, it wasn't. I still had more times to see him, but it was coming and it was coming close. So, yeah, I think that memoir is a chance to start that conversation with yourself and say, how do I really feel? What do I really obsess over and what are the things that give me wings? So I know Love Dad would not have come about without the man who loves everything, because it introduced that man into the world and he wasn't there before The Man Who Loves Everything. He was sort of a shadow self, trying to get by, trying to do okay, trying to survive. And then, there was something about writing Love, Dad, and I'm still conscious of it now, because now the book's out. The voice that wrote Greater City Shadows and You Belong Here will show up occasionally and go, well, what's going on? Like, what's happening with it? And I'm like, it's happened. Love, Dad's happened already. But the critical self doesn't really get how that could be, how I could write something that's just a gift at the time of publication. And so Greater City Shadows is kind of, I have like an inner critic in the room that's going, this has got to be good. I'm going to bust you until this gets done. And then there's an inner sage that sat with me during Love, Dad that goes, no, it's cool. He's learning. He's trying new things. He is taking a risk. And I want to comfort him for having taken the risk, not for the reward that might come at a later point. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about how you dealt or grappled with that filter that inevitably comes up when you are, being vulnerable and writing from that place of vulnerability in a memoir form. Did you find it hard to kind of get past that and let that inner sage kind of guide you, or did it come quite naturally to you?
It was a bit of a battle, and so certainly Love, Dad is populated by those two figures, by inner critic mostly, and then the inner sage showing up just in time. So I think that one's ego has a lot invested in success and achievement and belonging and all that stuff. So what I was conscious of was that I had to be comfortable with me being that vulnerable more than anyone else. So there was a point where I thought, once I'd finally got there, I thought, well, if someone has a problem with this book, I'm going to get it. I'll go, I know. Yeah, I am annoying. I know that. You think I don't know that I'm annoying sometimes? So there was some comfort in the sense, once it was complete, that I knew that I was me for better or worse. But in the lead up, I kind of felt like the men police were going to knock on my door at any point while
I
was running.
The men police?
Yeah, like the men police who sort of represented a token man, and they were going to go, mate, there's definitely, you're mentioning feelings, you're mentioning needing tenderness, like there are all these things we've made a solid agreement on not talking about and we want you to stop. But I also felt like there was a growing group of people, particularly younger than me, who weren't of that type. And I really wanted to get that book to them if they just had a baby or they're about to have a baby, or even if they were just a young guy trying to work out what they wanted to do with their lives. I think that the anxiety bit made that a little harder because they would have had to go to a counter with a book that said anxious on it. But I also know that the work within that, it was like, if I want to reach these people, I can't pretend I'm groovy and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Because I need to be real with them.
Yeah.
And raw with them. So that was the deal I made, was that I almost thought, well, I'm going to take a bullet for vulnerability and tenderness in the hope that someone else feels like this too.
Yeah, what a selfless and generous thing to do.
I don't know about that. Crazy is probably the better word.
And maybe a little crazy. I think that's the beauty of it. I think you do have to, step out of your comfort zone and be a little bit crazy sometimes.
Yeah.
And it is rewarding. I think sharing those experiences is, incredibly profound and can change people in really big ways.
Mm. I mean, the feedback I've got from Love, Dad, and actually from Greater City Shadows already, dear friends working through it as we speak, and these texts would come through story by story.
Mm.
And she just read the next one and she wanted to share that she appreciated something about it in terms of openness and things like that. It opens up a different kind of dialogue with your friendship circle. And it's interesting, the people who want to connect.
Mm, that is interesting.
In such a space. So I know for me, I thought it was a bigger deal when I made a mistake than it actually is to the greater world. And that it's kind of a relief sometimes when you go, hey, I'm struggling with this. So the other thing I was conscious with in Love, Dad, which talks about Greater City Shadows a lot, is that I knew that writing was hard. From my own personal experience, I knew there are any number of writers out there trying to get their first book deal or trying to get a debut publication, And so on some level, I wanted to give them an experience of someone who had sort of gotten publications. Part of writing Love, Dad was also wanting to acknowledge how vulnerable writers are, and that I know from personal experience, the writer's journey is not this upward trajectory where everything works out and you get win after win after win. And so as someone who had a couple of books out in the world or a book out in the world at that time, I also wanted to say to emerging writers, you know that feeling you're having and that fear that kicks in, that's really natural and you will get there. And if you persist, you'll get to the point that you're dreaming of.
Yeah.
It's just you're going to have a few dark nights of the soul along the way with all of that. And so, yeah, there was a point I was working on a story called The Butterfly Fish, which is in Greater City Shadows, and it got published by a little, or not a little lit journal, I shouldn't diss them, they're a great lit journal, called Island in Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the edit from the then editor, Ben Walter, and it was 11:45 on a Sunday night. And I was in bed, and I had my laptop, and my wife was asleep. And I started laughing, and I woke up, and she's like, what are you doing? And I said, it's so funny, because this edit is a work of art, and it's so gentle, and it's so honoring what the story wants to be. And he would have sat there, probably on a couch, doing this for the love of it, like for the love of story. And now here I am at 11:45 on a Sunday. The pay's terrible, you know, like the house is falling apart, but I love the story and I want it to be great.
Yeah.
So there's something kind of surreal about it. It is kind of crazy because the lit industry is so not commercially motivated at the grassroots level. So you have all these wonderful sort of artisans really lovingly preparing things at a lit journal level. And then at some point, you have to enter the grown-ups room where the publishers are and they say, okay, but how does this work? And part of you wants to go, it just works.
Yeah.
You don't even need to ask. It's great. And part of you knows on some level you're going to, yeah,
fantastic.
Trust me, it's amazing. And part of you knows that the publishing world doesn't really work like that. So I had a friend of mine one time when he looked at an earlier draft of Greater City Shadows. He said, you need to get it out of your head that we're art curators. He said, we're not.
Mm.
We're suppliers to bookstores. We need products we can supply to bookstores that they know that they can sell. And so...
Gosh, that's bleak, isn't
it? It's hard, right?
It's hard to hear as a creative.
Well, and certainly in a genre-based space or a commercially motivated-based space, I know what would be required to get my work into that space.
Mm.
And I like nothing about what would be required to make my stories more like that.
Mm.
It would take out every bit of subtlety I use would have to be broader, and every sort of niche reference would have to be more accessible. So I couldn't write a story where the characters are obsessed with the band Girlfriend from 1995 because they go, why aren't they obsessed with the Spice Girls? Or you'd need the biggest reference at any point. And at some point, that kind of becomes a bit of a circle jerk where you're just mentioning the big hit
stuff
for the sake of it.
For the sake of it.
Between the Lines.
Between the Lines.
Between the Lines.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you might like to check out others on offer at RTRFM.
Like the award-winning podcast Songlines, chart-topping Sovereign, First Pressing, Mortgage Mag and Favourites Movie Squad.
Plus, don't miss The Wild Orbit of Planet Perth with Jeff Bullen, tune in to Australian Melodrama with Libby Noble and meet local authors on Between the Lines with Danielle Raphael.
Head to rtrfm.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to explore on your home of alternative stories, RTRFM.
To Greater City Shadows now, Laurie. How did you come up with the name? You mentioned that it had a different name.
Yeah, so originally it was called Nova. And Nova is a star that increases its brightness suddenly and then comes back to its original state, which is an amazing image, but it's also a very niche idea for a book story
going
collection.
Back to the niche discussion.
And so it also began with two letters to the reader, addresses the U, and that was called Nova and Supernova, and that's how I started and ended the collection. And I also, on some level, I knew that that was scaffolding of a sort, but it felt very necessary in terms of the heartfelt stuff. So one of the good things about Nova in that sort of conceptual state is that a visual artist approached me at the time from Melbourne and said, hey, I'm creating some work. do you have any stories you want to share with me? And I said, well, actually, I'm working on a whole collection.
Yeah.
And so I sent her that manuscript and she created artwork out of a bunch of the stories, and she had an exhibition in Melbourne called Short Stories.
Oh, wow.
And so one of the lines that is in Nova, the original Nova, is in one of those paintings, which is, I think, I miss you and I love you and I'm with you every day. And so that's one of the paintings in the exhibition. And from that point on, Nova sort of worked as it was working through with my editor, and we'd sort of take a story out, put a story in. And she was pretty sure that the opening and closing bits wouldn't really work in a normal short story collection format, but we sort of persevered. And stars were always a big motif, and they're still in Greater City Shadows. So that was really guiding me at the point. And then at the point of Nova sort of hitting a big wall, aside from the Henry Handel Richardson flagship fellowship acceptance, even then I was still just thinking about the types of relationships I wanted to explore, so familial, friendship, romantic, and everything else. And so I'd sort of assemble them together. I have a whiteboard, and I'd have like All for Love is a story in there about these kids at high school. And that was always the midpoint. So it would go into All for Love and come out the other side. And so I kept working away at all of that. And then at one point, I realized that the Laurie that was has this sort of melancholy about him up to a point in his life. And I wanted to write some stories that weren't so melancholic. So the last bit I did was really work on a series of stories that are in there, which include The Heart and the Moose, which is about a guy and his dad, Breathing Lessons, which is set in the office, and I'm just trying to think what the third one was. That will come back to me. But basically, I had to work on a series of stories where the deal was I would end in sort of hope and wonder. I had a star party. That was the other one.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so those ones all kind of came at once.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous one.
Yeah, so it felt like a real gift to sit, bring me into the room. And the other thing that was really funny, because obviously this was drafted prior to Love, Dad, is that there's a story in there called The Present, which is probably the most semi-autobiographical story in the whole thing, about a guy being a dad to his two kids. And when my friend Brooke read that, she said, wow, that's really interesting, that story. It's a really good story. And I said, are you joking? And she goes, no, it's really interesting to me. Like I'm captivated by this thing of early parenting and stuff.
Yeah.
So that led to Love, Dad, but it also led to honouring a story that kind of inspired another book in Love, Dad, which is what The Present did. But The Present, I talked with another friend about The Present and whether it was allowed to be in there now that Love, Dad existed. And he said, well, yeah, it's a vital part of this book. And of course you honour and acknowledge that. So trying to then find cohesion and convergence, it was really a matter, again, of walking back around to WA, around to Perth, and thinking about the way that Perth builds these big things and then not much.
Yeah.
And while all that's happening, wonderful lives are being lived and incredibly kind gestures are occurring in a back street or at a house. Someone's hugging someone who's crying or all that kind of stuff. So then it was like, I want this to be the story of Perth, but more of the people that I keep finding, almost like angels, like these wonderful people that show up just when I'm like, oh, this is the worst, this sucks.
Mm.
And then someone will show up and they're so kind and they're so patient. And I guess the question that I kind of ask and I hope I have answered was, what would happen if people were honest, if people actually shared what they were really struggling with? And I think things would be better.
Mm.
I really do. And I didn't know that until I wrote Greater City Shadows. So it's funny, the hope that comes when someone says, I need help.
Mm.
And what shows up when someone says, I'm not okay. All this sort of generosity and compassion and kindness that enters that space. And then I guess finally, having grown up playing football and sports like that, I was also conscious that as I've grown up and studied and done other things, I met these kind of calmer kind of men. And I wanted to posit the argument that these were real men. Yeah. If there's, it's a loaded term, but I wanted to include them in that definition of men.
Mm.
Because men has so many token things
mm-hmm.
that are at times, sometimes destructive or harmful, that I wanted to say, hey, what if guys were like that? And so the other thing that happened when I was working on the book was I was working developmentally with another editor, and she read the punch, and originally the contender talks to a young woman on the tram. And she said to me, look, it's lovely, but why does it always have to be a woman? And I thought that's such a fascinating, interesting insight that on some level men have this sort of thing where they expect a woman to introduce them to tenderness and femininity. And what if a guy could do that on his own, or if another guy could facilitate them feeling safe in that space of vulnerability? So, yeah, I mean, I have some pretty strong thoughts on all of that. I didn't want that to dictate the collection. I more wanted to have conversations between men and women, fathers and sons, and see what they came up with. And occasionally a man became a fish.
Yeah.
Other slightly surreal things I hadn't seen coming, or I invented a whole new artist I didn't know existed in the last story, The Crazy and the Brave. They all kind of just showed up when they were ready to.
Yeah, it's a collection that takes you in so many different directions, but in a cohesive way. It's just, wonderfully ethereal at times as well. Like you mentioned, there are those moments of just joy or kindness that you don't expect, and it's a wonderful thread. There are also, as you mentioned, some very Perth, Western Australian references. I think you mentioned Osho at one point, which is a very
that's a time
very
and a
obscure and esoteric reference.
Yes.
How do you go about writing, you know, about place? Would you have any tips for writers who are perhaps wanting to delve into the place that they're living in, or you know, is there a process that you use? Is it more observation? Is it more heartfelt and feeling?
Oh, look, I think specificity is vital. So again, the wonderful Dr. Zizi Packer, she has two statements that always sort of stick around in my head. And one is specificity is authenticity. And the other is if you can't see it, hear it, touch it, taste it, and smell it, then it doesn't exist. So I would encourage anyone to get into the space they're wanting to look at and think in all the senses and go, okay, well, how does this look? How does this feel? And the other thing I would encourage them, if they're going backwards in time, to pay attention to are the figures that framed the reality of that time. So Osho was a very deliberate reference because my mother was a theatre actress and she had a lot of Osho followers in her friendship circle. And so it was a very interesting time because, you know, Lucy, who you'd met 15 times, would come in and go, I know my name is Archangel, you know, whatever, not that. But they'd have a different name and a different following and a different belief structure. And there was a kind of a liberation in watching them do that. But even as a young boy, I could also see the fallout of that, or there was just, it was interesting to see how people made meaning.
So interesting.
I was always obsessed with that. I was interested in see when someone said, this is what I believe, because I'm secular, I just see angels and people and they're kind of deities. My friends are deities and the whole world is like my own living book that I follow. But some people don't, and they have quite solid traditional structures of meaning, or they go outward and find an esoteric form. So I'm always interested in that. And so that would be my other bit of advice, is to think about what made that time not the most high profile thing, but something that's maybe telling. So I haven't really set much of my stuff in the 70s, but I was talking with someone the other day about the music of the 70s and people like Nick Drake and Janis Ian and Don McLean, and how earnest and how sort of open they were within their lyrics and wanting to be emotionally open and sometimes melancholy, sometimes longing. And so that's interesting in itself, especially when you get into the sort of the colder 2010s climate of a certain type of music that was going on, that muted emotion stuff. So, yeah, I go on dates with my characters, and I'll sit in a park and I'll talk to them, and they'll talk back to me and I'll take notes. So I'd really encourage you to both inhabit the character space as well as the place, because place really, in a narrative sense, only exists in relation to the character and how it either confirms or goes against how they feel about something. So that would be my advice there. And I'd encourage them to write about Perth if it speaks to them, because I'm amazed more people don't.
Yeah, it is such a fascinating place.
Unbelievably so. And it is conflicted. I mean,
yeah, and that's what makes it so interesting, right?
Yeah. Well, even the alleyway that I talk about in the first story, Greatest City Shadows, has this big security gate now. It never used to have it, and it does. And it seems almost like a poignant metaphor that they've locked that away and gone, no, don't go into that sort of more abstract space. We've built this wonderful plaza for you. Stay there. Consume, be happy, and move on. Whereas I think Perth's human population has a habit of bucking against it, certainly at the lower levels, of going, no, no, I want an experience. So one of the things I remember in the 2000s, I think it was going to the Beaufort Street Festival, and I grew up around here, and I remember walking that Beaufort Street, Mount Lawley, run through to Highgate so many times and feeling achingly alone. So I think over time, from the 80s onwards in particular, things started to change. And that's the other exciting thing, is I hope my kids never know what 1980s Perth felt like at times and how lonely it felt and how sort of small town and hot. I hope they go into a small bar and have a great conversation with someone. I hope they have all these moments of recognition and sharing. And I guess that's one thing I didn't have, for all its pros and cons, was that shareability of technology and things. But I'm pretty sure it made me the writer I am, all that time to think and reflect. So now when I do meet people and talk with people, I think, I mean, Perth, but even Mount Lawley is an incredible place.
Yeah.
And on through, really, if you were to do the run from Highgate to Morley, the amount you'd see in that small period of time and the different types of people you'd find. And I guess the only other thing I'd say about that is the why. Like, if you go, I want to write about the Astor Theatre, why do you want to write about the Astor Theatre? What part of the Astor Theatre do you want to write about? Do you want to include characters that are familiar to you or different to you? So the why is always a big part of what I do in terms of my writing and my stories, because the why means that if things don't work out in the big wide world of recognition or sales or whatever else, you still know you did it well and that you're excited about it and that you're proud of it, and that can go a long way.
I love that. And I love the way you think so deeply about things, Laurie.
And
think beyond, you know, the surface. Before I do let you go, because I realise we've been chatting for ages, I've just been enjoying listening to you, to be honest.
It's been great to talk with
you. It's been so nice. What can we expect from Laurie Steed? I know you've just released a book, so it's probably the most annoying question ever. But no, what's next?
It's all good. No, I've been working on, I mentioned Keridwen, my friend. She helped me start on a new novel. Which is kind of even more, a bit more supernatural and a bit more surreal.
Cool.
And it answers a few big questions, I hope. And so that's currently called Illuminate. It's a novel in progress. And that's my main thing I'm doing right now. I also work at Writing WA. I'm the partnerships manager there, which I really enjoy as well. And other than that, I guess spend some time with the boys, spend some time with people.
Beautiful.
And connect when and where I can.
A beautiful way to leave it. A wonderful message as well. I think we need a bit more connection and kindness in the world. Laurie Steed, thank you so much for joining us on the pod today.
Thanks, Danny.
Thanks for listening to this very first episode for 2024 of Between the Lines, a book podcast all about writers, publishers and poets based in WA and specifically Perth. I hope you stick around for the rest of the year. This episode of Between the Lines was produced and edited by me, Danielle Raphael. Between the Lines is written and recorded at RTRFM on the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. They were and still are the original storytellers. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.